Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to this conversation. We're talking today to Janet Sarbanes. Her book is called Army of One, a series of short stories that she's written. She grew up here in Baltimore. She right now lives in the Bay Area in San Francisco, where she teaches narrative writing and theory of narrative in the MFA writing program at the California Institute of the Arts. And this book, she is here in Baltimore to talk to people about her new book. It's good to have her back in the city. And Janet, lovely to see you again for the second time.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
A little bit of history about you. You grew up in Baltimore.
I did, yeah.
But writing was not the first thing you did, right?
No. I mean, I always sort of wrote as a child, but it took me a while to get to a place where I felt that I could write as an adult, I guess you would say. I went to graduate school in English to be an English professor, and I still do some of that. I teach on the undergrad also at CalArts, and so I use that degree. But I also teach in the writing program there, and so it wasn't until my early 30s that I really sort of let loose and started writing fiction.
And is a short story the form that you're the most comfortable with, or is that just your first publishing?
It's funny because people always, there's a sort of truism that you start with short stories to sort of build up to a novel. For me, I write short stories. I really enjoy the form, particularly because in the writing process, you can sort of, it doesn't take very long to write. So you can just be in a particular mood and sort of dash it off. With a novel, you have to stay with it for a very long period of time. So I find that writing short stories is something that I like to do and that I can do when I'm in a period of transition or I have a lot of things going on and I don't have the time to sort of sit down and write a long novel. But, you know, sort of writing conditions aside, I really like the form because it is a kind of brief flash of illumination, as they say. And
I like that, a brief flash of illumination.
Yeah. And you can kind of, you can conjure up a world, but you don't have to stay in it that long. You can go on to another world.
Right. Yeah. And you do.
I do, yeah.
the worlds you walk through, I mean, clearly it's obviously a woman, but it's a woman's spirit that runs through this book a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That you can feel in the from the little girl.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about her for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the people that you bring into Join Hands is that story, is that right?
Right, that's right.
About a little white girl who is in a all-black or mostly black elementary school in Baltimore.
Right.
Because you seem, let me just throw something out at you, then you can think of something you might want to read from there as we're talking about this. What struck me about that was the complex view, though a simplistic view through a little girl's eyes and heart and brain, of race and racism kind
right.
of turned on its head. It was really a very unique look at that world.
Right. Well, all of my characters are sort of charging at windmills, which is to say they're sort of idealistic in some way. They want the world to be a better place. But with that little girl, Grace. She is it's sort of a dream that she inherits from her parents. And I thought that was what was interesting about that situation is that she's going through one of the first experiments in integration, as are all her classmates. And so she's inherited this dream, which is Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream from her parents. And that's what's taught in school, and that's what everybody's trying to bring about. And then as the years go on, sort of the adults fail to achieve this. And the students fail to achieve it also, sort of, you know, in its kind of, perfect realization, I guess you would say. But I think through the sheer fact of trying, they're still doing something. And so You know, at periodic points during the story, they, in different grades, it's sort of structured by the grade levels that she goes through. They all get together to celebrate MLK and sing "We Shall Overcome," and they keep coming back to sing it. And the principal tells them to sing it like they mean it, and they do. They mm-hmm. continue because they do mean it, whether they're able to achieve it quite yet or not. So it's sort of, you know, it's set in the 70s, and it's it's trying to evoke an era when this experiment was fresh.
It also, though, I mean, what really struck me was the little girl, Grace, who had this young girl who became her friend,
mm-hmm.
who was black.
Mm-hmm.
And when the little girl told her she couldn't be her friend anymore,
mm-hmm.
I mean, what? And I reckon what was interesting to me, to see, which we seem to be exploring on at least one level, was, I mean, you always hear the story in the South about the black kid who's told by a white kid,
mm-hmm.
"I can't be your friend anymore,"
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because you're white, because you're black,
right?
And just kind of the and but so this thing was full of that and full of this class thing of little girl leaving a public school, now going off to a private, I guess Bryn Mawr kind of school,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To go to an almost all white girls' school.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was pretty profound and troubling in that way to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did you find it troubling when you were writing it?
Yeah. I meant for it to be troubling.
You did a good job of it then. So tell me about what you were thinking as you were in, about that, what that world says to you.
Well, I mean, in part, it was based on my own experiences in Baltimore, going through school. I went to a wonderful school, Mount Royal 66.
Oh yeah.
Up through eighth grade, and then I switched to a private school, which was Bryn Mawr.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So, you know, I think a lot of my observations on sort of what was possible and what, sort of what wasn't possible or it seemed to be at that time in the late 70s sort of went into this story.
So what does it say to you about the world of the progressive white families?
Oh, right.
And having their children be in almost all black experiences when they, even the families themselves don't have their all black experiences or have mixed experiences.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a moment. I think these experiments are important and, you know, they continue to be so. So I'm not meaning to historicize it. Or these, I shouldn't say experiments so much as efforts and attempts to make our society, which is still very segregated, you know, regardless of wonderful events that have happened recently, to try to change that. And a lot of stories in this collection are about the disparity or the difference between what people hope they can do and what they can actually accomplish. But I'm not one of those people who fault the parents for trying, you know?
No. You weren't doing that at all.
Right.
I don't find, one of the things in all your stories seems to be an absence of blame or guilt.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That doesn't seem to come through in
right.
the work.
I write satire, but my editor calls it lyrical satire,
mm-hmm.
And maybe that just means you take the hard edges off. But I like to think of it as, you know, using humor to be critical without being damning in a certain sense. So there's these characters, they sort of have a kind of innocence to them that isn't. You know, that isn't evil, that is compelling, I think, in a certain way. So that you laugh at them, but sort of by the end of their, whatever their mission or journey is, you sort of, hopefully you're kind of won over to it a bit. I don't mean just to send them up, but to sort of celebrate when people are sort of a little quirky and don't quite read all the signals the way they're supposed
mm-hmm,
to.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can sort of be creative in their approach to life.
Would you like to read a little piece from The Little Girl? Remember your favorite part? Then I'm going to switch to a different story here and have you read something else.
Maybe I'll just read starting at the beginning. Is that okay?
Sure, that's fine.
And the story's organized according to grade level, so it starts with K, which is kindergarten. "Look, Grace, your teacher's name is Grace, too." Grace stops crying and turns around and looks at the name on the door, which is hers, and the beautiful black woman standing next to it, one long braid circling her head like a crown. Grace is momentarily blinded by the possibility that she might grow up to look like that, which is not, in fact, a possibility. When she turns around again, her mother and father are gone. It is 1973, she will learn later that day. She lives in Baltimore, Maryland, and the name of her school is Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary. The other Grace steps forward and takes her hand. First, in kindergarten, everyone played nicely together, but in first grade, they're learning to read, or not learning. Plus, they don't have their own playground anymore, and at recess, the other kids are bigger than they are. The violence trickles down. Grace spends most of the morning in the bathroom. Pam, a gentle girl who isn't learning to read, comes to get her. "Grace," she calls from the doorway, not even checking to see if she's in there. "Teacher says you have to come back to class." The next person who comes to get Grace is a fifth grader, Yvette, the hall monitor. Yvette kicks in the door of every stall until she kicks in the door of Grace's stall. Grace is holding a book on her lap. Her pants are down. She goes back to class. Grace is actually in love with her first grade teacher, so she doesn't really mind. Her first grade teacher is beautiful, too, but in a different way than her kindergarten teacher. She wears big silver hoop earrings and bell-bottom jeans and ties her blouse above her belly button. Sometimes she wears army pants and a canvas belt with holes in it. A giant afro surrounds her head like a storm cloud. The older kids say she is a black panther. "Or a tiger," Grace says, nodding, and they call her a fool. She learns to be more careful with words.
I love that. It's just so real, and I think that I've never read anything from about that, about the situation of a young white kid in an all-black experience, the sensitivity and not being kind of a racist sensitivity. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's really kind of a very interesting perspective on all that, which you never read.
Thanks.
Let's talk a bit about Alien Encounter for a minute.
Okay.
I love this one. This woman in Alien Encounter reminds me of I think a little bit of the woman in When I Retire.
Yeah.
They remind me they could be sisters. They could be the same person for all I know.
Right.
I guess it's this surrealistic realism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you write about this alien encounter
as
if it were real.
Mm-hmm.
There's illusion here. This is, and the scene the sexual scene that you write about.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty amazing. Everybody wants to go find an alien now.
A few people have said that to me.
there's this one line, and we can talk. As I read to you earlier that you have in here that. Some lines just popped out. When I read this line, I was in the middle of the airplane and I just started laughing. It says, "Is the anus the key to human civilization?" she asked. "You tell me," the alien said. "I've never seen one." But there's a lot of alien stuff in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about your fascination with aliens.
Oh, okay. A lot of these stories are set out in the desert.
There are lots of desert stories.
Outside of L.A. And
obviously, you spent a lot of time in the desert.
I have. I actually, a long time ago, I was able to get a little house out there for very, very cheap, and that's where I go to write.
Okay.
It's incredibly quiet. And, it, you know, there's this amazing...
You and Ethel Fugard go off to the desert to write.
That's right, yeah. There's this amazing landscape there. You know, obviously it's very flat. There's this great expanse. There are also mountains sort of in the distance. And then there's Joshua trees, which are these strange Dr. Seuss-looking trees, and teddy bear cactuses, which are these sort of stumpy, they have stumpy arms, these fuzzy cactuses. And it's a really otherworldly landscape. So you already feel like you're on another planet. And you're out away from the city, and sort of the stars and the heavens are sort of very prominent, and they really impress themselves on your consciousness. And there are a lot of people out there who believe in aliens, and there's a whole culture around that, and it really makes sense. You start to see, because you're so far away from civilization, and yet there are all these strange things happening in the sky. And there's a marine base out there as well, and that puts more strange things in the sky.
You stumble across marine base a lot in your stories.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And that has a big impact on the culture. So I wanted to do a sort of a loving exploration of the kind of alien encounter myth. It's more of a rural myth than an urban myth, I guess you could say, that... That's really strong out there.
Is it a myth?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say it is a myth. I mean, when I say myth, a myth isn't necessarily untrue, but it's a way that people, it's a story people have developed for making sense of things in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a lot of fun with that in this story, and then I thought, you know, what it would be like if your alien encounter was actually a romantic or sexual encounter, because actually the sexual aspect of it, or the anal probe, as you pointed
right.
to, does feature prominently in a lot of alien encounter stories.
But this isn't just an alien probe we're talking. This is one of the few romantic sensual encounters with an alien that people I've ever read about. Really,
yeah, and. At different moments in time, I think the alien myth, as it were, has meant different things. So in the 50s, it was a Cold War kind of mythology, and it featured alien scientists who were going to pick people up and explore their inner organs and disorient them and then send them back to Earth. And I was interested. I saw a National Enquirer a while ago, before I wrote this story, that had aliens who were kind of like these hippies. You know, they wore beads, and they were just partying, or it was a disco in their spaceship, and they came down. And I thought, and they were really sort of groovy, loving aliens. And I thought, oh, okay, so the myth has gone in a different place, in a different direction. But it's still saying something to us about ourselves and who we consider to be alien at any particular moment in time. So I thought I would pick up on that kind of vision of the alien as a kind of loving and superior being, because that's another way that people experience aliens, a yearning for a race that's human-like but is somehow sort of more enlightened than we are.
Yes, your alien was loving, enlightened, sad, and lost.
Yeah, yeah.
That leads me to a few things about this from the alien story. But let me ask you, is there a part from the alien? Do you have a favorite part in the alien that you like to read for people? Or would you?
Well, I don't know, Mark. Do you want me to read the sex scene?
Sure, why not? I like that. Let's do that. That's a great scene.
Okay. And the alien is also a wonderful handyman, and he works with electromagnetic fields, so he's able to do all this work on her house
quickly
for her.
Yeah. But he did a little slower than he could have.
Exactly. You're a good reader. He did a beautiful job on the paint, ochre with blue trim, the colors of the desert in the late afternoon. The night he finished, as they were sitting out under the stars, he asked if there were anything else he could do for her, or if he should be moving on. "Maybe you could just be with me," she said, tracing the inside of his hand shell with her finger. "I'm so happy with you." The alien blinked and drew her to him by surrounding her with an electromagnetic field. "Me too," he whispered. "You know, I could have finished this whole job in just a couple of hours." But there's one thing I'm afraid of, she said weakly. Everyone's warned me about it. The alien dropped the electromagnetic field, and the two of them fell back into their respective lawn chairs. The anal probe, he sighed. She nodded, eyes popping out of her head. Everyone she knew who'd had an alien encounter, except for the sheriff who carried a gun, had been subjected to an anal probe. She didn't really understand why a crackerjack team of alien scientists would travel millions of light years to perform that particular exploratory surgery, but her neighbor's descriptions were too vivid to dismiss. "Is the anus the key to human civilization?" she asked. "You tell me," the alien said. "I've never seen one." Reassured, she took him inside. They lay down on the airbed in the living room and took off all of their clothes. The alien was an ectomorph with a narrow, concave chest. She was an ectomorph, too, so at least they had that in common. She tried to see if the alien's sexual organs resembled the ones in her dreams, but as soon as she laid a hand on him, his entire body gave off a bright green light that obscured her vision. Lying there, wondering what to do, how to pleasure an alien, she suddenly realized that this was how he was going to make love to her, with light. As he waved his shell hands over her, she didn't feel more clitorises and vaginas form, as she thought. Instead, she felt every cell in her body explode with pleasure. It was like shooting up OxyContin the way her neighbor with the cereal box fence had described it. She felt so stupid. Of course that was what sex with an alien would be like. Drugs. Afterward, she wondered if the alien had gotten anything out of it, but was afraid to ask. He spent most of his time playing with her ear, caressing it, licking it, burying his little alien nostrils in it. "What is this?" he cried out at one point as his body light turned from green to gold. "Is this your anus?" "No, no," she said, alarmed. "It's my ear." "Ah," the alien groaned and fell back on the airbed. She did have nice ears.
I love that. This is great. So, but one of the things, that whether it's this or the tumbleweed story, a lot of those stories, there's a theme that seems to run through, at least for me in the reading, is your view of like almost a pansexuality that humankind has, as opposed to these narrow definitions of heterosexual, homosexual, whatever those things we put ourselves in. And you have this kind of, in the way you write it, because it's not like, it's a very kind of gentle view of it, because your sensual scenes are not like hard sex scenes, they're just very sensual scenes. But they make no, seem to make no assumptions or put people in boxes when it comes to sexuality.
Right, right. Yeah, and with the alien, actually, she realizes she's not actually sure if the alien is a he or a she.
Right.
And she asks him, "Are you a he or a she?" And he says, or it says, "I don't understand the question."
Right.
And so for the rest of the story, the alien is referred to as it. And there's a lot of that, in the stories, a kind of, I'm thinking that's in the Tumbleweed, the Wonder Valley as well. Partially because I do think human sexuality is also another place where a sort of openness leads to creativity, and these characters are not, they don't come with preconceptions, and they often find themselves in situations where everyone else is sort of thinking one thing and they're thinking the other, or they didn't sort of get it. And I think when you expand that kind of openness and innocence, as it were, to human sexuality, you can have interesting results, and it can be sort of transformative of other people's thinking, as it is in various stories.
You made me think of someone I know who's a woman I've known for a long, long time. And 30 years ago, 40 years, whatever that was, we were together. And she was a friend of mine. Now she's with a woman. And we talked about it one day, and she said, "No, I'm not a lesbian. I just fell in love with a woman." And that's the kind of sense you get out of your stories, that it's not kind of pigeonholing people into this little teeny boxes we always want to put them in.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think some political identities are important, or they're important just because our society works on categorization. So unfortunately, so sometimes, you know, you need to kind of take a stand for this, that, or the other, because some experiences are not respected or sort of treated as equal. In my fiction, I do like to posit a world, in a sense, where you're using different words to think about these things, because it sort of jars our thinking and actually gets us in touch with the fact that human sexuality is much more fluid than we allow it to be.
That part of that is your running through the book. You said political. Running through the book also is a sense of a deep sense of social justice, and that's almost political but not political in the way that you look at it. I mean, your characters are always talking about it.
Right. It's sort of what I'm going for is something that's ethical, that's applied to the social. And politics can be ethical, and at its best, it is ethical.
cannot be as well.
Right. And an ethical approach to social problems can often not be political in the sense that it's not necessarily accounting for power dynamics. But that's the approach that my characters take, yeah.
There's also a sense, and we get to a couple of other stories, just to kind of get a flavor from different stories you've done, but also a sense, I think, of there's a lot of a sense of loss, not loss, but being lost. This kind of wandering through it.
Right. Being lost can be a positive orientation.
It's not one of these, woe is me, sad, I'm lost, where do I find my life? But the notion that we are all in some ways constantly lost and just trying to find the world and picking up these experiences as we go.
Right. Doing the best we can.
Because it can be, it's not morose.
Well, also I think one of the things I was trying to get at a little bit is the modern existence that we often do feel lost. I have in A is for Anarchy, there's a character who is she's in one of these new communities, which, you know, we have here on the East Coast, but there are definitely a lot of them in California, and they're sort of always popping up, especially sort of in the desert, because it's the last frontier for that kind of thing. And
let's build on the desert. Let's kill the desert and build these stupid houses.
Exactly. And so even just the street markers and things aren't there to orient yourself. Other characters get lost in the desert, as in When I Retire, when they're going out to see that giant rock where the aliens are supposed to come.
That's a great scene.
Thanks. And that being lost is a sort of being open, and again, it opens you up to possibilities when you lose your orientation, that sort of things will appear that you wouldn't otherwise see. So there is a lot of that.
Let's take a couple more stories here. We could be here for all day just talking about each story, the young girl who writes her aunt in Greece, your very beginning. Mm-hmm. I mean, her aunt. A Greek-American girl who writes her aunt in California, which I find a very kind of loving story of pulling family closer through this weird place between a little girl and her aunt.
Right.
You have this story, The Wild One.
The Wild Child.
Wild Child, excuse me. Wild One was the movie, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. The Wild Child. that was an amazing story.
Mm-hmm.
Again, set in the desert.
Right.
These drifter cowboy, druggy, crazy motorcycle.
Yeah.
On an old movie set in the desert.
Right.
And a wild child who had been raised by coyotes.
Yeah.
That was a very, very wonderful piece. I mean, kind of touching the kind of feral spirit. Feral, I should say, not feral, feral spirit.
You know, wild children are interesting because it's never been proven that they actually there are a lot of stories about them living with animals or running with cheetahs or, you know, and developing superhuman speed and things like that. You know, it's not clear that that how much that is the case. But I thought I would go with that. Often you think of children being raised by wolves. And I thought, you know, a child raised by coyotes, because that's sort of what we have in the desert. And coyotes have their own character, which is sort of wily and scrappy and that kind of thing. And then sort of the wild child sort of makes a choice to stay wild, right? There are these characters who are trying to civilize her. And treat her as a abused little girl, because at some point she was abandoned, obviously, and she was left out in the wild, with the best of intentions. And then what does it mean when she chooses to escape again and to go off with the coyotes? What does that say about what we have to offer in a certain sense, or what these characters are offering her as civilization? You know, she doesn't want her hair combed or her dress fixed or her a room of her own, kind of thing. These things that are projected onto her as things that she's missing. And what does she have that we don't have, that the humans don't have? So it's that kind of meeting of human and animal, or the wild and the civilized in the desert. Again, there's a fine edge out there.
I think. It's wrapped around things, other people's lives who are also trying to find themselves.
Yeah.
Who come to the desert.
Yeah.
Washed up movie actors and
right.
Somebody trying to figure out how to write again. And
yeah.
The woman who took over this town to create a resort. And,
yeah. Yeah.
And all that is right. In there too.
Right.
All wrapped around this wild child.
Yeah.
One of my favorite pieces in this is there a little piece you like in The Wild Child you'd like to read, and we'll move on to another story, or would you?
I could read the end of The Wild Child. Remember the day they tried to get the girl to come down from the hills, the day of the mirror and Grady singing his sweetest song? Well, that evening on the way back to my room from the saloon, I saw something move down at the end of the street. I went to look, who wouldn't have, but I hid behind the building and peered around the corner, afraid to get any closer than that. Which is how I saw not her face, because her hair fell forward, covering it, nor her reflection, because I was standing to one side of her, but the wild child gazing at her reflection in what must have been its terrible beauty. Her half-animal, half-human, half-girl, half-boy, half-young, half-old, half-lost, half-found, half-in, half-out, weary, wary, wily, wise, ignorant, innocent, shivering, shimmering reflection, and how I saw her touch her long, crooked finger to the cold, hard glass and laugh.
That's great.
Thanks.
I love that. And this, we'll close out here. And I just, your last two pieces in the book, the last two stories, Army of One and A for Anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these women who are middle-class women,
mm-hmm.
Professional women,
mm-hmm.
who are living in that world,
mm-hmm.
trying to find their place
right.
in the ordinariness of their lives.
Right.
Trying to reach out and find out what that all means.
Yeah. There's sort of the limit case, because they're very, you know, in A is for Anarchy, she's a suburban mother and stay-at-home mother. She's sort of, through her son, discovers all these sort of anarchist writers and thinkers, and it transforms the way she approaches her book group and book club and everything else. I wanted to put sort of in a way to show two figures who you would think were sort of very far apart, but actually, there's a kind of common idealism that runs through the suburban ideal, the anarchist ideal. And she says with just a little bit of tweaking, they could be the same thing. But it's all in the tweaking. You know?
It's all in the tweaking.
Yeah.
Janet Sarbanes, has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for writing this book and letting us talk about it. It's
Thank you so much for having me.
Janet Sarbanes, the book is Army of One. And stay with us, because we'll be right back with Irene Pepperberg, author of Alex and Me, to find out what an African gray parrot can tell us about the minds of animals. Don't go away. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Mark Steiner, and we have the pleasure to talk to Dr. Irene Pepperberg, whose book is Alex and Me, her latest book, How a Scientist and a Parrot Uncovered a Hidden World of Animal Intelligence and Formed a Deep Bond in the Process. She's an associate research professor at Brandeis and teaches animal cognition at Harvard. And welcome, Irene Pepperberg. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So talk about your sojourn. I was really fascinated that you really didn't start out your intellectual academic life even thinking about animal cognition.
Not at all. I was getting my doctorate in theoretical chemistry at Harvard when I saw NOVA programs on the signing chimps, on dolphin research, and on why do birds sing. And having had a budgie as a pet, had multiple budgies as pets during my lifetime, mm-hmm. I knew how smart they were, and I knew they could talk, and talk in context, if not really referentially, but at least in context. So it just occurred to me, why isn't anybody doing this work with birds? So I decided to be the person to do it. When I first started the work, my then husband had a job at Purdue University. They had hired him. They had not talked to me in any context whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And when I went to the department head and basically said, okay, I would like to put in a grant and start this research, the attitude was, no. We hired your husband. You're supposed to stay home, bake cookies, and make babies. So that wasn't exactly what I wanted to hear. And it's a bit of a long story, but we convinced the dean to sign a grant proposal, and the first proposal was rejected. The reviewers were basically asking me what I was smoking, because at the time everybody was working with chimps, which are genetically close to humans, mm-hmm. or dolphins with large brains. And as you've mentioned, the concept of a bird of doing anything having to do with intelligence was just considered absolutely crazy. Plus, I wanted to simply talk to the bird. I didn't want to use the standard techniques of the day, which were operant conditioning, which means starving your animal down to about 80% of its normal body weight, putting it in a featureless box, and testing it with, say, colored lights, seeing if it could match red lights to red lights and green lights to green lights and things like that. Think about yourself skipping lunch and then think of yourself at 80% of your normal body weight. It didn't seem to me to be the way to work with an animal that if you wanted to really communicate with it. And the weird thing about it was that papers were being published in Germany, in German, of course, that had been going on for about 30 years, showing the intelligence of these birds, particularly the gray parrot. Work done by a researcher, Dietmar Todt, showing that this modeling technique that I wanted to use was really, really successful in training these gray parrots to communicate. So I did have a basis for the research, but again, most people in the States hadn't read those papers.
Let me jump back a bit to when you decided to move over and start studying avian intelligence and animal cognition, and just to describe why you decided to choose these African gray parrots and how you chose them, which I found really interesting.
Well, I decided to use a gray because there had been this baseline work and because they're such clear speakers. They have a slightly different musculature that allows them to talk very, very clearly. And I chose this one bird in particular. I didn't actually choose him. There were 8 or 9 birds in a cage. And I had the fellow who was working there choose the bird for me so that nobody could argue that there was something specific about the bird I had chosen.
Now, do you think, people have asked this before, but that you have some other parrots you're working with, griffin and other parrots, that, gray parrots that you have. What's the difference between Alex and those parrots? Is the fact that you worked with Alex more than you had time to work with them?
Yeah, we had Alex for 15 years before any of the other birds arrived on the scene. And for those 15 years, Alex was an only bird. And we treated him the way you would treat a toddler. So it wasn't just during the training sessions, but during the day when he would ask for some food and he'd say, you know, want corn. And we'd say, here's corn. It's yellow corn. The color is yellow. We talked to him about everything around the lab that way. And that kind of intense one-on-one, in addition to the two-on-one training, was not something the other birds had. They had Alex interrupting all of their sessions, which was Griffin's case. And Alex, you know, we try to do color with Griffin, and Alex would say, no, you tell me what shape. And poor little Griffin would shrug his little birdie shoulders and look from Alex to me and go, you know.
What did you learn about the communication between Alex and Griffin and the other birds?
We didn't learn too much about how parrots interacted. There was a lot of dominance hierarchy in the technical term, or jealousy in the layman's term, amongst the birds. They didn't like one another very much. There was a lot of competition. Alex had to be top bird. He had to be greeted first every day, or he wouldn't work the rest of the day. We did learn a lot about the fact that Alex, because he spoke so much English, and again, it wasn't language the way you and I are having this kind of conversation, but it was a two-way communication between Alex and the students and myself, that became the dominant force within the laboratory, and the other birds really had to use that if they wanted to be attended to.
Let's talk a bit about that, though. I mean, in some of the other work I read and your other book as well, I mean, we talk about the brain structures in birds. And how the avian brain is similar or dissimilar to some of the language structures in our brain.
Yes, there's some beautiful work. There's a 2005 paper by Eric Jarvis et al., where et al. Are 20 other people, showing the similarities, not structurally in the sense of looking the same between bird and human brains, but in terms of functioning the same way. There are the same seven centers. In birds, it's the songbirds, it's the song centers. In parrots, it's the communication centers. In humans, it's language centers. Seven centers in these three very different organisms, and these are used for the learning, the storage, the memory, the production of vocalizations.
Those vocalizations that Alex made all these years, and the intense verbal relationship you had with him for 30 years, what does your science say about what was going on with Alex? I mean, what do you think he knew?
He understood the use of all the labels that we taught him.
Mm-hmm.
They were always used in context. They were always used appropriately. If he said he wanted a grape and you gave him a banana, you would be wearing the banana. I could give him two objects and I'd say, okay, what's here? Key. You know, what's same? Color. What's different? Shape. What color bigger? Green. How many? Two. So he was listening to all those different questions that I would ask. And know from which set of answers to choose the appropriate one. So it wasn't a simple stimulus response. Okay, you see this object, you say this thing. He had to listen and understand that there could be multiple questions about these same objects.
And I wonder what you think that says just about the way that parrots or other birds of higher intelligence might actually communicate with one another, how that sets their own social structures up.
This is a really, really good question. We tried to do some work on this in Africa. My students got, they're called sonograms. You basically take a vocalization and you use a machine that puts a graph of frequency versus time so you can see what the vocalizations sound like. And you could cover three picnic tables with the different vocalizations that my student was able to tape. We could separate them into aggression or affiliation, alarm calls, things like that. We couldn't actually understand what they were used in for the birds. That would have required a lot more work. And it was actually quite dangerous there. The students were chased by machete-wielding poachers and things like that. So we couldn't do as much as we wanted to. But we're convinced that these vocalizations in the wild have some level of meaning. We just don't know the details.
And do you think there's a relationship between any of that and the language that you taught Alex? Do you know what I mean?
Yes. I think that it would have been impossible for us to give him labels for, say, colors and shapes and objects if that was not built on something already in his mentality. I'm not saying that necessarily gray parrots label colors the way we label colors, but he had to have concepts of colors as separate from concepts of shape to be able to understand what we were teaching him. It's almost impossible to teach an individual those kinds of concepts unless there's some kind of underlying structure already there.
Since Alex passed away, are you still working with Griffin and is it Arthur Wart?
Wart? Correct.
Yeah,
Wart's his nickname. Yeah.
Wart's his nickname, right. Are you still working with them?
Yes, I am. We're training up Griffin, particularly to finish the optical illusion studies that we started with Alex. We started a project literally to determine how they see the world. And this is an ongoing project now.
You write about and have been interviewed about how difficult it has been for you to get grants and positions to do your work. And I wonder if that's changed now with this book and with all the all the kind of attention you've received since Alex's death. Has that changed?
Well, in the short term, no. I'm hoping maybe in the future it will. In the short term, I'm still being supported by bird clubs and speaking fees. Huh. When I give a talk at some place, I ask them to write the check to the Alex Foundation so that we can use that to support the research. It is quite difficult. You know, I talk about in the book of living on 14 tofu meals a week.
Right, I know.
Yeah, and you know, it's that you know, the book advance has helped on that score a little bit, but it's still hard, and I still put an awful lot of the book advance money into the laboratory, so that we can keep it running.
Why do you think it's so difficult?
Well, it's controversial because a lot of people still find it difficult to believe that these animals have these kind of intelligence and communication abilities.
Mm-hmm.
But to be very blunt, right now our economy is such that
What really fascinated me is that there are parts in here where Alex actually made up words, where he would add things together to create something. He didn't know what an apple was. He created a word for an apple.
We were training him to say apple, and apple has internal P's. Now think about saying a P sound without lips.
Right.
It's not easy. And initial P's are a little bit easier, but internal ones are really tough. So he came up with the label Banary, the idea of it looking like a big cherry and maybe tasting a bit like a banana. And what was interesting, he would do a lot of this kind of labeling, playing around with his labels. We did a study where we taped him during what we called the dusk period. We were gone, but there was a little night light in the lab for about an hour before between the time the main light went off and the night lights came off completely. And he would sit there playing with the sounds that we were training with him. So he'd say, bean, green, sheen, keen. Or he'd go, you know, banapple, banary, banana, ganale, ale, bale, bale, nail, nail. And things like that. From gray, he went to great, grain, chain, cane. And we, you know, gave him a chain of paper clips or a nutmeg grater he could play with. Or sugar cane. And he liked those things, so those labels went into the repertoire.
Parrots live for a long, long time in captivity, longer than they do in the wild. And the relationship that a parrot and a human being can develop can be pretty intense.
Yes, any individual that you live with for 30 or 40 years is pretty intense.
And so what about you and Alex?
We were colleagues for the whole time that we worked together in the lab. And I say this not in any kind of pejorative way. You think about some individual you work with every day for 30 years. You really care about this person or this bird or this individual. But you draw a line between your work and your personal relationships. And you have to keep objectivity, to keep a professional relationship. And for the 30 years that we worked together, that's what I did. I certainly cared about him in so many ways. But, you know, I drew a line. I had to be very careful when I was evaluating the data that I didn't want him to do things so much that I would overinterpret it. But when he died, that barrier just crumbled, and I realized what I had been denying and pushing away for all those years.
There are a couple of things here. You, Alex, had these ideas of what he liked. You write about his wanting to go to the lobby that was close to your lab, and he wanted to go see tree.
Correct. That was a treat. So he could look outside, get some sunlight, things like that. Yeah. Animal care regulations meant that he really wasn't supposed to be in places like that. He was supposed to be in the laboratory at all times. But we bent the rules every once in a while.
I was going to ask, the next thing I was going to ask was about that, when you talk about the animal care regulations. And I wonder, when you have an animal like this, I mean, was there any qualms about always having him locked up in a laboratory, something as intelligent and as vibrant as a parrot like Alex?
There was, but that was what we had to do. And it's the funny, it's the unintended consequences. People who are trying to improve the lives of animals who break into animal care facilities, that's why they're in these locked boxes, because of for protection. But we made this as enriched an environment as possible. Somebody was with Alex 8 to 10, sometimes 12 hours a day, interacting with him, talking with him, playing with him. So it wasn't as though he was, you know, locked up in a cage. He had this large room that he had and that had all these people to interact with. So we made it as exciting and interesting as possible.
So talk about the interactions he had with Margaret Atwood and the novel she wrote, Oryx and Crake, which is a great novel, and how this term corknut got to be his. And talk a bit about that story.
Yes. Well, first time Alex saw a cork in a shell, he called, saw an almond in a shell, he called it a cork, which made sense if you see the two things together. And again, that was very interesting that he had extended what he knew was the label for a cork to something that looked like it. So we made him call it cork nut so that we could separate the two objects. And this label became an important part of Margaret Atwood's novel. And so when I learned that she was going to be in Cambridge to receive an award, I invited her to come visit the lab. And it was quite exciting to have her there. And, of course, Alex refused to say the label corknut for the whole time she was there. And as she walked out the door and walked down the hall, there he was going, corknut, corknut, to the students who were still with him. So I don't know why he did that, but it was very frustrating.
You wanted to do this study with Patrick Kavanaugh. I mean, talk a bit about this theory about how their brains work and do they literally see the world in ways that we do, as you write about, and how they might be different.
Right. Well, birds, if you know, they see the world monocularly, one eye on each side of their head. We see things binocularly with both eyes facing forward. Yet somehow their brain works so that they have good depth perception and they can function appropriately, obviously fly with great, very great perception. So the idea was, could we get some kind of window into the way they perceive the world by testing them on the same types of tasks that you test people on? So we started with one illusion called the Mueller-Lyer illusion. It sounds fancy, but everybody knows what it is. It's two lines, one with arrows facing inwards, one with arrows facing outwards, and the inward arrow facing line always looks shorter. And that's an optical illusion. And it may have to do with depth perception. There's a lot of possible reasons for the illusion, but it was a simple one. So we tried this with Alex, making the two different lines different colors and asking him what color bigger, what color smaller, so he could tell us the color or say none if he thought they were the same size. And it turned out he saw these exactly the same way we did, which was quite exciting. So we went on to some other optical illusions. It's called the inverted T, where think about a T made up of two lines that are exactly equal in length. But the vertical one looks longer to us than the horizontal one. And we started working on this illusion with Alex and with variations of it. And it seemed that he saw this one a little bit differently than we did. And the point was he saw the T version as we did, but he didn't see the L version quite the same way as we did. And we didn't get a chance to finish that. We didn't get a chance to determine exactly what was working on this, whether the fact that we were using two colors instead of one color, which is the standard form for humans, could have been important. So we're going to try to do this with Griffin and train him up on his colors and shapes and numbers and see if we can get this done.
So I was going to ask you now that when you the kind of things you thought about when you found Alex in his cage, 31 is pretty young for a captive parrot to die, and where that's going to take your work next.
Well, I actually didn't find him, thankfully. It was a technician. Friday mornings are the only days that the techs come in before we do, and that was a Friday that we found him. It was absolutely devastating. I mean, I know that Griffin is really smart. He's done some very, very important things before. We have papers published just on his work. But he was not where Alex was, partly, as I said, because Alex would interrupt all his sessions, and partly because one of the things we did with Griffin was to test out alternative training techniques. And these were not successful, but we learned a lot scientifically about why they weren't successful. That was good, too. So he's about a quarter of the way, you know, where Alex was for his age. So we've got a ways to go to get him up to speed. And, of course, I knew that it was going to be hard to get the funding to do that. And the time involved in doing it. So those are the challenges facing us now.
I wish in some ways we could close this with some of the way you kind of closed your book. I really love that last chapter of your book.
Thank you.
It's very moving and very heartfelt. And you talk about the way you looked at Alex and your own kind of spiritual way of looking at those things. And how the feeling that she has was best expressed, you said, by Isaac Dennison's Out of Africa. Talk a bit about that to us.
It was the idea that for whatever time Alex had on Earth, he was teaching us about what it meant to be a non-human and how we could look at non-human intelligence and look at the similarities and differences and learn about what these animals could do. As humans, we tend to test animals with human types of tasks. It's important to be able to say, well, Alex was the equivalent of a, you know, X-year-old child. But the bottom line is there was a lot of things that Alex probably could do in the wild that you and I couldn't do. For example, he saw in the ultraviolet. So he saw far more in terms of colors than we did. What other things could these animals do? We have so little understanding because we look at animals purely from a human-centric point of view. And I think Alex's legacy, I would hope, would be that we would open our minds to think about the kinds of things that these animals could do and their overall intelligence.
Aaron Pepperberg, this has been a pleasure. If you ever come down to Baltimore, D.C. to speak, we'll find you and talk some more. Or if we get up to Boston, we'll do some more talking. It's been lovely to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Oh, again, thank you for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. Tune in tomorrow for an interview with another great author, Margaret Atwood. That's On the Mark Steiner Show at 5 p.m. on WEAA 88.9 FM. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered this hour by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Lloyd and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And to hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews on the web, you can visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.